Okay, everybody, so welcome back. I'm just sort of getting sorted out, and we'll be ready for the final session. And in this session, we're going to be looking at some more of the evidence, and we're also going to be finishing off with some of the skeptical arguments. Savants. Okay. So, moving on, the next phenomenon we're going to look at somewhat briefly is the phenomenon of near-death experiences, which I'm sure you're all familiar with in some way or another. NDEs are widely reported, and generally they agree with the accounts of rebirth in the Buddhist texts. I mean, they have a lot of variations, but in terms of the overall picture of things, one of the issues with the near-death experiences is it's difficult to establish them independently. There are some verified claims, but they're hard to find. What we mean by a verified claim or something like that, of course, if somebody dies, you know, maybe they leave their body, they have an experience of white light and bliss, and they meet their relatives and all of these kinds of things, well, it's very difficult to show that any of that stuff actually happened. Is it just purely subjective? Some people say it's oxygen deprivation. Recently, I heard a theory, somebody saying it's from a toxin which is found in toads. It's like a toad toxin thing that you find in people's brain, whatever. But a way of verifying it is if something happens during the near-death experience, if you can definitively prove that someone's actually brain dead, and then during that time, if something happens which they can later remember and verify. But of course, it's difficult to do that, because if somebody, for example, is, you know, dying, then people have usually got something on their mind other than checking whether they're having a genuine near-death experience, right? So it's not easy to match these things up, but there are some cases. There's a fellow called Sampania who's been doing some research on this. Benel, you might know more on this than myself. Do you want to summarize this or just... Okay, just run through this briefly. He's been doing some research on and prospective studies on this, so trying to look at... people when they're having operations and things like that to see whether that they can have veridical near-death experiences. One of the things that he's found out through his studies is that the kind of the classical near-death experience, which we're all familiar with, you know, dying and feeling a sense of bliss and white light and a tunnel, meeting your relatives, making a decision to come back and so on, but this is only a one kind of experience that people have. And there, in fact, are many different kinds, and some of them are mentioned here. In fact, he describes seven kinds of experiences during near-death experiences. Fear, right? I was terrified, I was told I was going to die, and the quickest way was to say the last short word I could remember. Strange. No. Seeing animals and plants, seeing a bright light. Seeing family, being a classic one, being persecuted or experiencing violence, feeling like being dragged through deep water. They had to go through a ceremony which was to get burned. There were four men with me, whichever lied would die. I saw men with coffins being buried upright. Or experience of deja vu. And experience a tooth coming out when a tube was removed from my mouth. It's a strange kind of experience, but anyway. So the point, main point being that people have various different kinds of near-death experiences. I will just look briefly at this one. This is the Journal of Near-Death Studies, and here has a number of descriptions of possible veridical near-death experiences. This paper is, just to give you the background, by Kenneth Ring and Madeline Lawrence, Further Evidence for Veridical Perception During Near-Death Experiences. Case number one. Kathy Milne was a nurse at Hartford Hospital. She'd been interested in NDEs, and one time she found herself talking to a woman who'd been resuscitated and who had had an NDE. Following a telephone interview with me on August 24th, 1992, she described the following account in a letter. She told me how she had floated up over her body, viewed the resuscitation effort for a short time, and then felt herself being pulled up through several floors of the hospital, which must be kind of weird, I guess. But anyway, she then found herself above the roof and realized she was looking at the skyline of Hartford. She marveled at how interesting the view was. Which I also find a curious detail, right? You've just died and your soul has left the body and is floating up in the sky. Oh, that's a nice view. I didn't know what Hartford looked like from this angle. Anyway, and out of the corner of her eye, she saw a red object. It turned out to be a shoe. She thought about the shoe, and later she felt sucked up a blackened hole. The rest of her NDE was fairly typical, as I remember. I was relating this to a skeptical resident who, in a mocking manner, left. Apparently, he then got a janitor to help him get onto the roof. When I saw him later that day, he had a red shoe and became a believer, too. Yeah. Interesting story, yeah? Okay. It remains an unanswered question how these isolated shoes arrived at their unlikely perches for later viewing by astonished NDEers and their baffled investigators. Second case, in the summer of 1982, Joyce Harmon, a surgical intensive care unit nurse at Hartford Hospital, returned to work after a vacation. On that vacation, she'd purchased a new pair of plaid shoelaces, which she happened to be wearing on her first day back at the hospital. That day, she was involved in resuscitating a patient, a woman she didn't know, giving her medicine. The resuscitation was successful, and the next day, Harmon chanced to see the patient, whereupon they had a conversation, the gist of which, not necessarily a verbatim account, is as follows. The patient, on seeing Harmon, volunteered, "Ah, oh, you're the one with the plaid shoelaces." "What?" Harmon replied, astonished. She said she distinctly remembered feeling the hair on the back of her neck rise. "I saw them," the woman continued. "I was watching what was happening yesterday when I died. I was up above." And case number three. In late 1970s, Sue Saunders was working at Hartford Hospital as a respiratory therapist. One day she was helping to resuscitate a 60-ish man in the emergency room whose electrocardiogram had gone flat. Medics were shocking him repeatedly with no results. Saunders was trying to give him oxygen. In the middle of the resuscitation, someone else took over for her and she left. A couple of days later, she encountered this patient in the ICU. He spontaneously commented, "You looked so much better in your yellow top." She, like Harmon, was so shocked at this remark that she got goosebumps, for she had been wearing a yellow smock the previous day. "Yeah," the man continued, "I saw you. You had something over your face, and you were pushing air into me, and I saw your yellow smock." Saunders confirmed that she had had something over her face, a mask, and that she'd worn the yellow smock while trying to give him oxygen while he was unconscious and without a heartbeat. Okay, so these are three interesting cases, and these are examples of what we call veridical perception during near-death experiences. So you perceive something which can later be tested and confirmed. As you can see from the nature of those cases, it's all a bit ad hoc, right? I mean, it's a bit random as, you know, when these encounters happen and how you can test them. So this is why sometimes it's, you know, in my view, I think that these are significant, and I do believe that they are good evidence for rebirth or some kind of process after death, but I don't think they're as strong as evidence as the past life memories of children, which we'll be looking at next. Mainly for that reason, because I think they're just a bit hard to test. But Sam Parnia is doing some more research in that, so perhaps in the future that might be established more clearly. Okay. Do you have anything on that one? Yep. Okay. Do you want to do this one? Yeah. Oh, do you want me to do the intro? You're going to do the Stevens one. Okay. I'll just do the brief intro on this. So we'll now move on to look at memories of past life by children. Memories that appear to be of past lives can appear spontaneously through hypnotic regression or through meditation. The Buddha's standard for reliable memories was that they should be based on the fourth jhana. The best case studies that we have today are with children typically under seven, as studied by Ian Stevenson. And we have a couple of videos on this, so let's have a look at the videos. And the main video we're going to be looking at is a very well-known case of James Leiniger, the young boy who recollected past life as a fighter pilot. And this was a case which was studied by Jim Tucker, who was the inheritor of Ian Stevenson's work. And this is a report from Fox News. One of the interesting things about this particular account is that, apart from his facial expressions, is the fact that you get to actually see them a bit later on in the video when they go back to the place where it all happened. And that's, to me, the most powerful part of the whole video. But anyway, let's see this story of James Leiniger.
11-year-old James Leiniger looks and acts like most boys his age, but beneath his playful spirit is a very deep soul.
And I said, I'm really glad you're my son, and I'm just really fun to have you as my son. And he says, I know, that's why I picked you.
When we first met Bruce, Andrea, and James in 2005, his passion for World War II fighter planes was obvious.
I can make the Japanese easy as pie.
The fascination began when he was a toddler. James seemed intimately familiar with the aircrafts.
He started doing these little drawings of airplanes shooting at other airplanes were being shot down. Bombing ships, you see men parachuting. There's another one where planes are dropping bombs. This is a carrier.
The violent drawings were followed by extreme night terrors.
He would just be crawling. He'd say, airplane crash on fire, a little man can't get out. He laid on his back and kicked up at the ceiling, and he goes, Mama, the little man's going like this. And he laid on his back and kicked his feet up. The little man's going, ooh, 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 can't get out. And I said, well, who's the little man, baby? And he goes, me. I thought Bruce and I were just going to faint.
Big question, what kind of plane?
For sale.
Why did your plane crash?
My plane was shot down.
Who shot your plane?
He looked at me like I was a village idiot. He said,
the Japanese.
Where did he take off from a boat?
Do you remember the name of your boat? He said, Natoma.
And his name?
He always said James. But his name is James.
Stunned by his son's words, Bruce tracked down veterans of the USS Natoma Bay.
I wanted to disprove it.
Columbus, Ohio native Leo Pyatt served on the ship.
He asked a few questions about, did I know some of the people? Oh, yeah, I remember those people. Yes, there was a Jim Houston, a rather large shell. Just hit him in the engine, and it pushed into flames and went down.
It was all real. James Houston, born and raised in the Midwest, was shot down over Chichijima, Japan.
He got very quiet.
The Leiningers were speechless again when James met Natoma Bay veterans and recognized them by name.
We're Bob Greenwald. I'm serious.
He never met Bob Greenwald.
No, he never met him before.
They tracked down James Houston's sister, Anne.
And he goes, it's not Anne, it's Annie. She wasn't my oldest sister. I had an older sister than that. And I said, you did? Who was that? And he goes, Roof. I mean Roof.
Eddie is what they called me when I was little, knowing my name and my sister's name, things that my brother did when he was a kid. It's too amazing to describe.
James recalled his favorite childhood possessions, and when we spoke to them via Skype, they shared one specific story involving James Houston's mother.
Annie had sent James the picture that her mother had painted of James Houston. And when James got it, he called Annie to thank her, and he said, where's the one Mom painted of you? And so she went and found it and sent a copy, and later on she told us that no one in the world except her brother and sister knew that there was an identical picture of Annie when she was the same age.
Amazing stories like that caught the attention of Japanese filmmakers. Not long after our story aired, they flew James and his entire family to Chichijima, Japan, and the site of James Houston's plane crash.
Took a tour of the island, got up on a ridge overlooking the harbor. James said, this is where the planes flew in the day my plane was shot down.
Without any help,
James knew exactly where the plane crashed. They held a memorial service and dropped flowers over the wreckage.
And James just got so emotional and just lost it. And it was just the most heart-wrenching thing.
But when it was over,
it was cathartic.
You know, it still gives me goosebumps to think that we actually got there and we were there and we were able to close the loop, especially for James, that it was something really important to him.
And when they returned, the death and destruction pictures were replaced with this.
There's dolphins and the Japanese ship has its flags flying.
At James's urging, they put all of this and many more incredible stories on paper and published this new book, Soul Survivor.
I hope that it helps people understand the meaning of how precious life is, how fast it can just blow away.
The Leiningers say they aren't promoting reincarnation. Before James, they didn't believe in it.
And I really believe that there's a purpose to this story and that the God that created us wants this story told.
And I also hope that it opens people's eyes up to reincarnation.
You do?
Yeah, I hope it opens people's eyes up to the fact that reincarnation can happen. It is a possibility. It's not a lie.
Suzanne Stratford, Fox 8 News.
Powerful stories, and it's very rare that you get to see the story unfolding. One of the criticisms of Ian Stevens' work is that often he's only able to discover the cases of children some years after the events have happened. But in this case, you actually see the boy as he's sort of going back to that place and you know, seeing that emotional reaction. And this is something which Dennis already talked about in the context of regression, and it comes through very often with the stories of children's memories as well. When they go back to the home or they meet somebody or something, there's a very powerful sense of emotional connection there. Do you have anything more to add on James Leiningers' story? Okay, so maybe, Venerable, do you want to talk about some of the biology cases?
Yep. Okay. So this is more of Ian Stevenson's research, and this is about what he called, this is actually all comes from a book that he wrote called "The Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect." And this is particularly interesting because very often, you know, you hear stories and you try to verify those stories from the facts that are around you. And but these particular things, they actually concern biological marks on the person, on the previous person, when they died, and then that actually reappears on the person who then claims to be that reincarnation in the next life. This is very powerful, right? You can see kind of the, you know, how something actually goes from one personality, moves on to the next one. And this is a very powerful way of, you know, of potentially at least showing the connection between lives. So let's just have a quick look at a couple of these cases, so because they are actually quite interesting. So I'll have a, this is from this book, which is quite fascinating. If you like to have a read of it, I can recommend this book. Where is it? It is somewhere. Okay, so let's just have, it looks like, how do you work this thing? Okay, so this is from India. It's a fellow called Hanumant Saxena, and he was born in India, somewhere in India. Now, where is he from? Uttar Pradesh, which is in northern India, so this is also where all the Buddhist holy sites are, in that particular area. So he, as you can see on this picture, he was born with this fairly prominent a birthmark on his chest, right? and there's nothing particularly strange about birthmarks. I guess many people have some birthmarks when they get born. But in this particular case, it is particularly interesting for the following reasons. How do I get my glasses? I can barely see this. Getting old now. This is nice. Okay, so let's see. So at when, the first thing here, when his mother, Hanuman's mother, conceived him, she dreamed that the man in the same village called Maharam, he appeared to her. And then Maharam, who had been shot dead only a few weeks before, in this dream, he said to her, "I am coming to you," right? And this is a very kind of common thing that you find in these stories about reincarnation and about, you know, people being reborn and remembering past lives. It's quite common for mothers, apparently, to have these apparitions. Somebody saying, "I'm coming to you. I'm going to be reborn with you." And of course, I suppose one of the interesting things that you could look at there is if men also have the same kind of dreams, right? Do men ever have a dream, somebody saying, "I'm coming to you"? And that would be an interesting way to see if there is a clear distinction there between the women and the men. Then that would be one kind of thing that lends itself in favor of this actually being a real, something realistic, rather than just a dream, which doesn't have any further relation to reality as such. So this is the first thing, very common experience, the mother dreams that somebody is going to be reborn with her, essentially, or not with her, but through her. And then, of course, the next thing which is very common that happens to these people is that when you reach a certain age, you start to talk about your previous life. And this is exactly what happened with Hanuman. When he actually began talking about this when he was 1 year old. Wow, he must have been very a precocious fellow speaking at 1 year old. And then when he was 3 years old, he started referring to the life of this Maharam. And he said that he had been Maharam, and he pointed to the birthmark and saying that he had been shot right there, right? That's interesting. So this is kind of the background story. He says all these things. And then later on, as he became familiar, because Maharam had just lived next door, not very far away, he actually started visiting Maharam's house. And he visited his mother, who still lived there. And he did that for a few years until eventually he got tired of that and he stopped doing it. Then, of course, the interesting thing is that these birthmarks, and this is, of course, the kind of the powerful thing, is then what is the correlation between the birthmarks found on this person and the actual wound of the person who died. This is what is interesting here. And what is so fascinating is the incredible closeness between the two. And we have another picture here. This is of a drawing from the this is a drawing that was done as part of the autopsy, or part of the what do you call these things? Part of his autopsy. Yeah, this was done as part of the autopsy, and you can see here, so these are two very separate incidents, right? The autopsy is one thing, and the birthmark obviously happened much later. And if you look at that, if you go back and forth between that, you can see there's a couple of things. You see the main mark in the middle with the one on it. And that is very similar to the main birthmark you have there. And then, of course, because it is a shot, it was probably done by a shotgun. So you have this spread, right? So you have all these little marks going around the main one. And again, it's very similar to the one on the previous page. Location is almost exactly the same. Couldn't be much more precise, really, than that, I think. Yeah. That's quite a fascinating story. And there are quite a large number of these sort of stories in the book. Yeah. Okay. So that is, again, there's two things here coming together, right? There's this idea that somebody is remembering the past life. That's one. And the second one, that this actually matches up with a physical mark that came from one personality to the next one. Now, one can, of course, maybe ask the question, why is it that these marks actually get transferred? And that, of course, becomes perhaps a bit more speculative, and perhaps we should leave that out. But I think the idea, from a Buddhist point of view, is that a mark is transferred because it leaves a very powerful psychological impact. You get shot, right? It is something which has a very powerful effect on the mind. And that mental impact then is then felt on the next physical body in the next life. I think Dennis was talking a bit about that as well when he was talking about that before. Yeah. Okay, so that is... Sorry, please.
Yeah, just on that, I mean, I think that, that obviously makes sense in this kind of case, but there are also cases where in certain cultures they'll actually make marks on bodies that are already deceased, right? So the body's deceased, and then on the corpse they'll actually make a mark so that they can identify the child in the next birth, right? And if the person's already dead, then obviously then that they're not going to have any psychological impact.
Maybe the ghost is cooperating, saying, yes, I will bring this mark with me here.
Maybe.
The ghost is
maybe
standing there, watching down, looking down her. Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. So that is the first case of biology, with biology and reincarnation intersect. And then we have another case. Let's have a look at this one. Now, that is pretty amazing, right? That's a pretty serious, it's not really a birthmark, it's more like a birth defect or whatever you want to call it. So somebody who has basically just very stumps for fingers on one hand. And this is another case from India. And this is a young boy, Lekpal. This is a picture taken when he was 8 years old. And he was living in a particular village. And while he was living there, while he was growing up, his older sisters remembered that he described to her how, in the previous life, he had put his hand into a fodder chopping machine. Right? This is what he said. He had this strange hand, and then he had this memory from a past life of putting his hand into a fodder chopping machine. He said that he had a mother and a father in Tal, so he actually gave a specific name, right? A particular place where he had been, or was lived in the previous life. And he had an older sister and a younger brother. He did not give the name of the person, however. And then eventually a villager from that particular town of Naglatal, which was nearby, Naglatal, not just Tal, who had learned about this case of Lekpal, they came over to his house. And then, of course, when they saw him, they became interested. And later on, after some time, they took him over to that other village. And he was able to identify a few of the things there. And then Ian Stevenson said that he was satisfied that no one from the other village, Naglatal, gave any information to that family. So there was no way that information could be passed across. So whatever memories he had seemed to have been basically from a past life. So the interesting thing here again is that here is somebody who has a... And of course, it then turns out that there was precisely a person in this other village who had died that way, right? Or he actually hadn't died that way, but he had put his hand into a fodder chopping machine, just like he remembered. Four fingers had been completely cut off. And then about a year after that, he had then died. So this mark had then somehow left some kind of residue, psychological residue, on the on this hand. And what is fascinating here is that this kind of birth defect, when all your fingers are cut off like this, is apparently extremely rare. You're talking about less than 1 in 1,000,000, if I remember correctly. I read this report somewhere else previously. So it's an extraordinarily rare condition. On top of that, then he remembers that it was happened in a particular village where that, you know, this event actually happened. So if you start to multiply the various probabilities here, you know, right, you have this extremely rare condition, he remembers a place, and in that particular place somebody had the hand chopped off, right? And also the idea that he was able to remember some of the things of that village, some of the whatever was going on there, you start to multiply that, it becomes almost impossible to explain what is going on, except through some the fact that it is a real kind of memory here. Yeah, and one of the things that is a little bit interesting here is the fact that the person who actually did chop his fingers off, he didn't actually lose his thumb. He only loses his four fingers, but his thumb was apparently intact. But he was reborn with all fingers cut off, right? And again, this is one of those little things that you, which actually to me makes the story even more likely, right? If this was some kind of hoax or some kind of deception, somebody was trying to kind of make this up, then they would make up a story which matched perfectly. They would say he lost all fingers in that accident, and that would be, you know, everybody would say, wow, that is really amazing, everything fits perfectly. But the fact that they are insistent that he only lost four fingers in that accident means, to me, it shows you that this is kind of this is the sort of thing that you will expect in real life. There are always inconsistencies, always things that don't work out properly. I'm sure you find the same thing, Dennis, in your research as well, right? There's always things that don't work out quite right. And to me, that is just a sign of real life being complicated and messy. And that, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, you might explain that perhaps by saying that, you know, the psychological impact is such that maybe the psyche doesn't really distinguish between whether it was four or five fingers that was lost. And so when upon rebirth, you actually lose all five instead. Anyway, that's just to give you some taste of these cases. And these are probably, I would think, some of the most powerful cases, these ideas where you have biology and recollection of past life actually coming together in this way. And if you're interested, again, this is the book where Ian Stevens actually discusses these things. Okay.
Any questions on that? Yeah, Alan.
About the near-death experience, what is described by these people is it's while the body is not active, they are able to see, to hear, and to think and memorize and so on. In Buddhism, we talk about the six consciousness, eye, ear, and so on, and the five consciousness associated with the body, in this case, are sleeping, if I could say. So how do you explain that having the five physical consciousness inactive, these people are able to see and hear and memorize?
Okay, I think that's the kind of question that's probably best addressed in the next workshop. We'll be looking at more of the implications and explanations around things, rather, because, again, to give a satisfactory explanation would probably take some time, yeah. So these cases which Ian Stevenson's come up with, where this is these biological connections, I mean, to me these are genuinely innovative. I'm not aware that there was any literature on these before the time of Stevenson, and seem to me some of the most strong evidence. There's not a small number of cases. There's quite a few hundred, over 1,000 cases. I'm not sure, you know, they're of varying degrees of strength in terms of the argument he's able to make. But it's one of the areas, I think, where we're able to sort of test things and, you know, objectively verify them the best possible. Okay. No more questions? Well, while we're on the topic of childhood memories and things like that, I'm just wondering, you know, we just had our discussion groups, and I'm just wondering if anybody had any good stories that came out of the discussion groups. Did anybody have any past life memories or anything that they'd feel comfortable about sharing with the larger group? Sorry? Prem? I don't want to feel pressure, because I know it is private, and if only if you feel comfortable with sharing something. Because usually every group that I talk to, there's always somebody has something. When I talked to a group about 20 Sri Lankans in a house in Sydney last year, same topic came up, and I asked them. I said, "Is, you know, anybody had any experiences?" And then somebody put up a hand and said, "Well, actually," and she started talking about her brother. And she said her brother had all these past life memories, and they're growing up in a village in Sri Lanka, and he was a pilot or something in the Second World War, but similar to James Leininger, shot down, had all of these memories, and they said, you know, he was just completely like English, all of his tastes and things like that. He liked English food and English tea and all of these kinds of things. And he had actually become one of Ian Stevenson's cases. Right? And so Ian Stevenson and his researchers would visit their family periodically when they were growing up and see how they were going and so on. And that was quite fascinating. But then the even more interesting thing was that after we finished that session, I went home, and somebody drove me back to where I was staying, And the fellow who drove me back said, you know, he said, we grew up next door to that family, okay? We're from the same village. I've played with them since we were children, and we've known them their whole lives, and they've never mentioned anything about this before. Yeah, this is the first time I've ever heard about this. He said, but we could always know that that brother was just totally different to everybody else in the family. Yeah? It was just so obvious. All of his tastes, his behaviors, his personality was just quite different to everybody else. So that was very interesting for me to hear. Anybody, we got any volunteers? Jamila. Would you like to tell your story, Jamila?
My mom told me when I was 3 years, I used to talk about my previous life, like I told her, this is not my house, my house is, it's very close to my house anyway, there's a house, big house, and there's veranda and all kind of things, and I used to wear sari and my hair always not like a typical Sri Lankan lady. And then I asked from her, I want to go there. Then she told me she didn't let me to go. My uncle wants me to take me and show, and then I can recognize that house. Then my mom didn't let me, uncle, to do that. Then he went and asked them, someone died here. Then they told uncle, yes, there's a lady died that time. Then my mom thinking is that lady is me. Then, but she didn't tell me when I grow up. Then I didn't go and check. Anyway, I know the house now.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, so this is one of the things, I think that these cases and these memories, I don't think they're uncommon. And I think if you ever, you know, if you get a group like this size or even a smaller group, you know, it's pretty likely that actually someone has had this kind of experience. Actually, one of Ian Stevenson's cases came from when they were driving through Thailand with one of his assistants, and they were discussing this point, and his assistant was saying, you know, I think these cases are a lot more common than we think. And so they said, okay, let's just test this. So they stopped at the next town, randomly stopped at a village, walked into the coffee shop in the village, and just said, excuse me, in the coffee shop, you know anybody know anybody who recollects any past lives? And there was a kid serving at the counter who said, oh yeah, my brother does. And so they went, and then he became one of the cases. So, you know, I think that actually it happens fairly often. And this is something which, you know, there's a lot more scope for research. Any more questions or comments on that? Prem?
From Jamila's story and also several others that I heard secondhand, so they are all geographically close by they get reborn. Is there any kind of evidence that is what, how the rebirth happens close to where you were, according to?
Yes, that is the case. Most of the time it tends to be fairly geographically close. I mean, on the one hand, obviously that's the easiest ones to verify, right? So you can understand that, but also I guess in terms of attachments, that we tend to be attached to where we live and to get reborn in a place that's close to that. Most of the cases are geographically fairly close to the point where someone's lived or to where someone's died. We discussed in the interview with Bhikkhu Bodhi, we discussed the all-important question of can you get reborn as an alien on another planet. And we seem to sort of agree that if you are like a really obsessed Star Trek fan, and so you're like, you know, you just really wanted, you know, aliens, you really think, then your mind is out there and perhaps you might get reborn there. So I think it's possible, but most likely, most of the time, you know, you seem to get born close to where you were, and you seem to often have connections with similar kinds of people, maybe the same people, not all the people all the time, but tends to be. And of course, that, you know, if it's karma, then karma is driven by your attachment, what you know.
Was there consistencies in time between the death of the previous life and the birth of the next?
Doesn't seem to be so. That's another area where it's difficult to get consistent information, but it seems to be that there are varying periods of time involved. Yeah, sometimes it can be quite a few years. Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you one story. I'm not going to I'll just tell you the story as it was told to me, okay? It was told to me many years ago by a very tall, thin French monk. And he, those of you who know him will know who I mean. But he told me this story that he had been to visit Bangkok to see a monk who had this renowned interest in psychic powers and who could see various kinds of realms and this kind of thing. And he went down to ask him about a story about a particular man who they'd known earlier. And this man, whose name escapes me at the moment, but it was a doctor, Dr. somebody, I'll see if it comes back. Oh, Dr. Douglas Burns his name was, I think, if I remember correctly, Douglas Burns. Now, he was a Westerner, a bit of an adventurer, a bit of a exotic character in different ways. But he had shown up at Ajahn Chah's monastery, he'd been interested in Buddhism and this kind of thing, and the monks had known him and so on. And at some certain point, he disappeared, right? He just vanished. Nobody knew where he'd gone, and his body was never found, and it was a great mystery. He was well known in circles in Bangkok and so on, so there was actually like a large-scale search for him, helicopters, apparently royal family got involved trying to find his body and things like this. But it was never found, and there were all kinds of rumours and speculation about what had happened to him. So this would have been in the early 70s, I think, that this happened. Anyway, so then this monk went to ask and see if he could find out any information about him. So this monk, who apparently was chewing betel nut during the whole experience, right? He would go into meditation and he's like chewing betel nut and he sort of back up and he sort of check up and down through the different realms of existence and stuff, and then he came back out and his meditation said, no, he's nowhere to be found, right? I can't find him in any of the different planes of rebirth, you know. And he said, tell me more about him and so on. So he told him more about him. And then he said, okay, let me try again. So he sort of went back into meditation and again checked in. And the story that he told, what had happened was that Douglas Burns had been walking through the forest, through a jungle and a jungle track in the south of Thailand. At that time there was quite a lot of insurgency in the south of Thailand. There were communist rebels around the place, and he'd been shot, and he basically had been shot completely out of the blue by a bullet that was just from an insurgent in the forest. And I don't even know whether they shot him deliberately or if it was just a stray bullet, but he had no idea what had happened. It was so sudden, there was no warning. And so according to this monk, he had seen or perceived somehow his consciousness, which was still in the area, and because it had happened so suddenly and without any warning, that he still had no idea that he died, and so his consciousness was still just kind of lost and wandering around the area. But when he saw the monk, and the monk projected his consciousness to the area, he saw the monk, he gained faith because he remembered, oh, this is a Dhamma that I've been following. And when he gained faith, then his mind became clear, and then he got reborn in a good realm because of that. In that case, if that story is true, then that was a few decades between dying and getting reborn. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. So if, but you know, obviously quite unusual cases. Usually you know that you're going to die, right? So it make a difference. Oh, yeah.
In like the video of James, yeah. He was a soldier and he was actually like probably killing, and he actually had quite a reasonable rebirth. So in terms of like in the cases that you have read, I think that you asked Dr. Tucker,
yeah.
And he actually doesn't ever focus on that, on the karma aspect of it. Right. But in the cases that you have studied and read, have you seen any connection with the action of the person's past life and their rebirth?
Yeah, that's a good question, and generally speaking, no. Right? So this is one of the things. There seems to be quite good evidence for rebirth or reincarnation. Okay, so we've seen a lot, I think a lot of strong evidence for it, but much less strong evidence for karma. Right? Now that doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means we don't have so much evidence for it. And our Venerable referred to it to this a little bit earlier, and the essential. The causality is hard. See, this is the thing. When you're talking about karma, you're talking about causality. And it's always hard to figure out causality, right? Why did you go to the shop now, right? Why did you watch this program on telly rather than another program, right? I mean, even simple things like that, it's hard to figure out the causality. You look at something like smoking, right? A great example, right? How hard it was to establish a real firm causal link between smoking tobacco and getting cancer, right? Even though there are millions of people smoking and getting cancer, right? But it's still very hard to establish causal links. So I think that's something which is to look at in terms of future research to see whether any patterns can be discerned. But it is something that's discussed explicitly in the suttas in a number of places, but especially in the Mahakamma Vibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha talks about that somebody can have a genuine vision of somebody getting reborn. Maybe they do some bad karma and they get reborn in a good place, right? And therefore they conclude, oh, well, you can do as much bad karma as you like and you get a good rebirth, hey, right? Or they might see the opposite, someone doing good karma and they get reborn in a bad place. But the Buddha said, of course, the reason is because you've made different karma in the past, right? So that the karma is complex. Someone maybe does something bad now, but they get reborn because of something good that they've done in the past. Yeah? So this is another. So from a practice point of view, we shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to draw conclusions from these kinds of cases. Yeah,
I think there's also another. A factor there, when I think this is something we discussed with Jim Tucker as well, and he actually talks about it in his books, whether there is an evidence for karma, because obviously it tends to come up with rebirth. And I think the problem is that first of all you want to kind of focus on the basics, right? The basics is there rebirth or isn't there rebirth? It's kind of the basic question. And that research isn't really finished yet. That research is still going on. And they have, 2,000 cases on record or something that they have been using to just establish that basic fact. And, you know, who knows when this is going to be accepted by, you know, by the broader community, so to speak. Yeah? And so for that reason, they haven't really focused on the idea of karma. They haven't actually looked at that aspect because they have been focusing on the more basic idea of rebirth. You know, you have to ask different types of questions if you're going to look for karma than you do for rebirth. So, you have to kind of change your procedures and the way you do that research, basically. Yeah?
It's something which is a bit... It's sort of even harder to fit into a scientific paradigm because you start talking about morality. So someone does a good thing or a bad thing, and then that becomes even more. Yeah. I mean, obviously, in the case of someone killing, then that's fairly straightforward. But there might be a lot of other cases where it's very far from it. Yeah. So yes.
Suddenly, I remembered something Venerable Jnana Vimala Jnana told me at the retreat.
Uh-huh.
He said, in Balanguda, very uh-huh. close to the area where he lives, there's a man with a terrible cut mark on his body who talks about his previous life.
Okay.
And how he was killed from the same locality.
Okay.
He said, that person is still living. Now only I remembered it.
Okay. We had a question over here first.
Yes, I mean, I come from a scientific circle, but physical sciences, this is more anthropological and social, and they are at best anecdotal, kind of maybe with statistics and that kind. Yeah. So my question is, over here, this group is a very biased audience, scientifically speaking. So how well is this accepted scientifically in the social?
The problem is that the vast majority of scientists are not even interested in looking at it, and that's part of the problem. Many of the people who do actually look at the evidence, they say it is very strong. Yeah. and this was one of the reasons, thank you for taking on the volume, and this is one of the reasons why we showed that particular thing early on from that physicist, and she was an award-winning physicist, and she said that having looked at the evidence, wow, it is as good, that evidence, as it is for any other of the physical sciences as well. So the problem is that people aren't even willing to look at the evidence. And a classic example was the physicist Lawrence Krauss. I don't know if you heard about him. Quite an outspoken physicist in the United States. And he talks about all kind of phenomena. And he's one of those who loves to debunk kind of non-scientific things, right? This is the way they do it. And he was interviewed. And he was asked about these phenomena. And the interviewer was saying, well, there is actually a lot of good evidence here. There is Jim Tucker, there is Ian Stevenson, have done decades of research on these things. There's really good evidence. Have you looked at it? And he said, no, I don't have time to look at that sort of stuff. I have to focus on the issues that are, you know, fairly mainstream. Otherwise, I will waste my whole life looking at things that are kind of borderline stuff. So that is the reply. We don't have time to look at those things. And that is one of the problems. So it actually gets dismissed without really being given a fair hearing in the first place.
Thank you. Bhante, you mentioned about the karma in response to what the bhikkhuni raised. One of the sutras that you recommended for reading, I think, is what was it, Sankharuppati Sutra? I think in that, I read because thanks to you, because you recommended in that list. And so I think there were five factors that Buddha has mentioned there, that Saddha, Sila, I will recall in Pali, Saddha, Sila, Sruta, Chaga, and Panya.
Yeah.
So those five factors. So if one practices those five factors, that you can, your intention to be reborn will come to fruition,
right,
sort of thing. So how does that, again, how does that reconcile with the other karma that one has done in the same life previously, if someone was not that good in the past?
I mean, I don't think that. Okay, so Ananda's talking about a particular sutta called the Sankharuppapatti Sutta, the rebirth according to aspiration, which was on the reading list. And there, it's a slightly unusual sutta because it's actually saying that you can direct your rebirth. Normally, of course, the Buddha said that you should try to end rebirth. Right? So it's not necessarily saying that you should direct your rebirth, right? He's saying you can if you want to, and saying that there are these supporting factors of faith and generosity, wisdom and so on, which, and if you have those factors, then you can make a wish and then use that to help direct where you want to get reborn. I don't think that's, obviously that's a simplification, right? It's not sort of taking precedence. I mean, it's not as if you can be a sort of mass murderer your whole life and then at the end of your life think, I'm going to choose where I'm going to get reborn. But it's just saying that these are general factors which can support and make it more likely that you're going to get reborn in a particular place. Yeah.
And of course, those five factors are all wholesome factors.
They're all wholesome factors,
So therefore, intention. But
I think if you have those factors, you can make the aspiration to get reborn in Perth in the next life, so you can keep coming to the BSWA.
Exactly. And why not? And also something that, this is a question arising to Dennis from what that question that was raised previously about the scientific evidence. Now, in my field, when we say verification comes to, especially in auditing, that if two people can do the same thing in two different ways and come to the same conclusion,
okay,
then it is supposed to have been verified.
Okay.
So that is the verification. Especially in what you are doing, Dennis, is it possible someone else to hypnotize in a different, I don't know anything about hypnotism, through using, someone used the word technique. So there must be different techniques. Is it possible the subject to be hypnotized by using another technique and then get the same results?
Possible, yeah. Or perhaps, you know, perhaps sometimes through hypnosis and then through meditation. But then, you know, also through, checking records and different kinds of things. So definitely, I think, you know, from my point of view, if I hear a story and someone has a story, then I take that story for what it is. You know, it's a story and, you know, that's it. And I'm not skeptical, and I'm not I'm not going to dismiss it, but nor am I going to believe that that's fact because someone told me a story. So it's when you can take that story and then verify it through some other method, that to me that that then you begin to say, okay, well, that's fact. Until that happens, and you say, okay, it's a story. I just have no way of verifying it. So there's this lovely phrase which you find in the suttas where it says, when the monks go to listen to some teaching and they don't quite know what to make of it, they say, neither rejecting it nor accepting it, but we will inquire about the meaning of it. And just to come back to that thing of bias, are we a biased audience here? I don't know, I think maybe, probably, but bias works both ways, yeah? And bias works just as strongly if you come from a, you know, rationalist, materialist background, that you're just as biased to dismiss things. So I think it's important to bear that in mind as well. Sympathetic is a very good point, yeah? And I think this is something which is often overlooked in the kind of skeptical arguments. You actually, you know, understanding something, right? In Buddhism, always compassion and wisdom have to go together, right? To understand something, you have to be sympathetic. If you want to understand another person, right? You can't understand another person by just being completely cynical and clinical and objective about it. You have to actually enter their emotions. You have to feel what they feel. You have to, you know, you have to connect with them. And I think the same thing's true for understanding anything. You know, you have to have a sympathy for it, and you have to have a regard for it and a wanting to learn from it. Otherwise, it's very easy to just dismiss things. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. It looks very real, but it's just a trick, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we can't find out how he did the trick. That's professionalism. Yeah. I can't argue against that.
Yeah. You know, the Buddha gave the same argument. Yeah, it's in one of the suttas, I think, in the, what is it, Kevada Sutta or something? Yeah, he actually says the same thing. This is why, one of the reasons why monks aren't supposed to talk about psychic powers and things like that, and make claims about psychic powers, basically because it's extremely easy to fake them. Yeah. And if you're familiar with the sort of the ascetic culture in India, you know, there's a whole kind of industry of faking psychic powers and magic events. You know, people go from town to town doing all of these
That's
things.
That's just a waste of time.
I think there's a big problem with this kind of so-called rationalist point of view, because very often you use the rational point of view, you use the rational mind to justify what is your viewpoint that you already have. And I think people don't actually understand the degree to what we are conditioned. We have views not because we are rational beings, but because we're conditioned to have those views. And that's why you see people don't believe in rebirth, and if something happens in their life, they start to study Buddhism, start to meditate or whatever, and suddenly one day they change, right? And they turn around, and suddenly they believe in rebirth. They didn't do it before. And what has changed? The only thing that has changed is the conditioning. They're just as rational afterwards as they were before. But we it feels like I'm being rational, but actually it's just the conditioning process. And because the conditioning process in the Western world, the large part of the whole world, is so much part of the materialist scientific kind of outlook, we are conditioned that way. We view the world that way. It's not any more rational than anything else. It's just conditioning. And it's so hard to see that, you know. And this is why it is so, you know, you can't actually see your own conditioning. And that is why the whole thing becomes so difficult and so complex.
I was wondering, the question is sort of like, is self-identity, the construction of self-identity, the thing that blocks the recollection? Because these kids, you know, I'm sort of speculating that as little ones, they haven't really constructed a very strong sense of a new self-identity as little children. And whereas, like in the very still meditations, the deep meditations, that sort of sense of identity sort of, I assume, has vanished, and then that's how the mind is so wieldy and can remember. So is it really just like the activity of the mind concocting identities which blocks the memories?
That's a really good thought, and I think there's probably something to that, yeah, because when you're kids, you're forming your sense of self, and you do that just as much by excluding things as you do by creating things. Yeah? So you've figured out what you are by figuring out what you're not. And I think that's probably something to that, and that's why meditation, hypnosis and so on, you're relaxing your sense of identity, and so you don't have those walls and constructs around your psyche. I think probably it's a very good point, yeah. And that may also be why sometimes these memories resurface in times of crisis and so on, because that's when there's ruptures in their sense of your sense of self. Yeah. Good point. Okay, let's move on, because we've still got a few areas to cover. Okay, so this is the final ones of our case of the different kinds of evidence, and this is the idea of ordinary learning. And this is something that I put in there because I think the more that I go on, the more that I think that this is actually something which is perhaps the most persuasive of all. But that's just my personal feeling about it. This is an extract from an interview with Noam Chomsky, who many of you will know as one of the 20th century's foremost intellectuals, and especially renowned as being probably the greatest linguist of the 20th century. And so the interviewer said to Chomsky, "So we're faced with a mystery. How could anyone possibly learn enough about the English language to possess the rich and exotic grammatical knowledge that we all seem to possess by the time we are 5 or 6 years old?" I know there are some people in the audience who have learnt English as a second language, and you will probably be able to sympathise with this, the rich and exotic grammatical forms of the English language, right? And previously in the interview, Chomsky has been giving examples of certain kinds of unusual syntax which you find in English, which are so rare that it's highly unlikely that a child will have actually encountered these particular constructions, and yet they can all recognise which is correct English and which is incorrect English. And so he argues that it's impossible for a child to learn a language merely by from hearing what people around them are speaking. And his answer is, there's an obvious answer to that. The knowledge is built in. You and I can learn English as well as any other language with all its richness, because we are designed to learn languages based on a common set of principles which we may call universal grammar. And so this idea of Chomsky's, I mean, it's surprisingly similar to the idea of Socrates, isn't it, that we began so long ago, that there's some kind of innate knowledge that we're calling on. Now, Chomsky was very, very much a kind of rationalist, and he explained this in terms of genetics, right? He believed that through evolution we have a predisposition through our brain structure and so on to do this, and so that's one possible explanation. However, it is an explanation that has no actual material basis, right? I mean, they haven't actually found the language structures in the brain and shown how they're derived from biology. It's purely a speculative explanation, and another explanation obviously could be in terms of karma and rebirth. And one of the things which strikes me about this is that, you know, we've seen the savants, we've seen the astonishing, you know, the skills in music, and we look at that and we go, that's so amazing. Why do we think that's amazing? Right? Why is that so astonishing? Really, basically, it's astonishing because it's unusual, because we've never seen something like that before. But the ordinary things that every single child picks up, to me, are no less astonishing. The fact that a child can so easily learn languages and learn all the things that a child does is just as amazing. It's no less complex, it's no less difficult, it's just more common. And so we don't think of it as anything unusual. So I think we're actually surrounded by this all the time. Yeah, surrounded by children who are picking up knowledge and so on all the time, and these occasional things that we see in terms of remembering details of past lives and so on, I mean, that's just the periphery, that's just the details of a few minor cases. But the most important thing is, I think, that children are actually carrying over a whole body of knowledge of all kinds of things which they're sort of gradually learning to make use of during the time when they're growing up. It's not something that I can prove, it's not something that I know of there being a lot of detailed research about it, but it's something that I have a feeling that there's something to that idea.
Could it possibly be simply because of our makeup that we have, that language gene in that region, so you know.
Could be. I mean, that's Chomsky's idea. I mean, I think a language gene would be a bit reductive, but something like that, sure. I think it's possible.
It's part of our biological makeup.
Yeah. Could be. Yeah. Could be. Any other questions? Ordinary learning. Okay, we'll move on. Okay, so now we're going to move to discussion of the skeptics. Payasi Sutta and Digha Nikaya number 23. Payasi Sutta, one of the most entertaining suttas in the whole of the Pali canon. Discussion between a monk called Kumara Kassapa, otherwise I think unknown, Kumara Kassapa? One or two other places, not a very well known monk, and a prince called Prince Payasi's sutta is very remarkable for a number of reasons. One reason historically is that it's the only sutta in the Pali canon which has a parallel in the Jaina canon. It's a shared sutta between Buddhism and Jainism. And in the sutta, the Prince Payasi, just to sort of give the background, he's sort of discussing these skeptical ideas with this monk, and this monk is rebutting them by giving all of these different arguments. And of course this sting comes at the end of the sutta when the prince says, actually you persuaded me with your first argument, but I just wanted to keep on challenging you because I enjoyed the debate, right? So, but this is one of the cases. And so this is what the prince says to Payasi. He says he gives an order to his servants. He says, take a condemned prisoner, throw this man alive into a jar, close the mouth of it and cover it over with wet leather. Put over that a thick cement of moist clay, put it onto a furnace and kindle a fire. It's not something you'd probably get past an ethics committee in kind of a modern research context, but there you go. I don't know, is it ethical to learn? I mean, this is like, anyway, okay, we'll go on. When we knew the man was dead, we should take down that jar, unbind and open the mouth and quickly observe it with the idea perhaps we may see his soul coming out. But we don't see his soul coming out. This, Master Kassapa, is for me evidence that there neither is another world nor is there rebirth other than by parentage, nor fruit or result of deeds well or ill done. So this is Payasi's use of scientific method, right? And it is very scientific, isn't it? Okay, you might have ethical quibbles about the manner in which he's gone about it, okay? But, you know, it's in service of a greater good and all of that kind of thing. But ethical considerations aside, it is... It's very scientific, isn't it? And he doesn't just do this, he also does a whole range of other similarly ethically questionable experiments. Not all of them are ethically questionable, and in each case gets a null result, which again, of course, is a good thing in science, right? A null result is just as meaningful as a positive result. And so the monk Kumara Kassapa then says, well, yes, but you haven't proved that there's no rebirth, and he gives a whole series of very kind of elaborate similes and arguments and so on to show that this isn't the right way to be looking for rebirth. So the sutra itself is, as I said, highly entertaining, but too long and complex to discuss in any meaningful way today. But we mainly wanted to put this in there just to show that this idea of skepticism, research, looking for evidence and so on, that this is not a new idea. It's been going on for a long time. And that, this idea... As modern day skeptics will often say that everybody in the time of the Buddha just believed in karma and rebirth and so on, and as you can see, it's not the case, that the people were questioning and inquiring and so on. Okay, so we had a bit of a look around the place to see if we could find arguments by different skeptics, and we wanted to say, okay, let's find the best arguments from skeptics that we could find. And we may not have done a very good job with this because we I think we felt a little bit disappointed I felt a little bit disappointed in the arguments of the skeptics. I thought I was hoping for something a bit more meaty and a bit more incisive, but most of the time the arguments I thought were a bit silly, really. But anyway, we thought we should look at them and then have a bit of an examination of the skeptical arguments. Do you want to take this one on, or
whatever? I was just going to say that, you know, these arguments here are more the substantial arguments. A lot of the arguments that you hear all the time is that, you know, people, it's about fraud and about faulty memory and about, you know, cultures where reincarnation already exists, so people are predisposed to believing in reincarnation and these kind of things. These are the kind of standard arguments you find. And many of those arguments are often just, you know, just because you are removed from a different culture and you don't understand that culture, that is often why you actually accept these arguments. The idea that people, you know, that you can dismiss all the hard evidence of reincarnation by the idea of fraud is very, you know, these are ordinary people, you know, stating ordinary things. And we hear here today as well, we hear people who had experiences, you know, of exactly the same kind of thing. And I think it is very, it is just being, it's not really, you know, these are not really powerful arguments when you have a very large body of evidence, as you have in the case of Ian Stevenson. So these ones here are more the kind of substantial arguments that are raised against the idea of reincarnation.
One of the things which came up talking with Jim Tucker as well is that there does, not to put too fine a point on it, but they seem to be quite racist, a lot of the arguments. I mean, there's basically, like, you know, these are primitive cultures, and one of them we looked at, it even said, you know, people in those cultures are less intelligent, right? Seriously, right? This is what they're saying. You know, if you go to India, why do the research in India? People there are less intelligent, yeah? And these kinds of things. And so Jim Tucker is actually focusing his research more on cases in America and Western countries for this reason. And we said to him, you know, this is kind of shocking. You shouldn't have to do that. And he said, look, I know, but that's the reality. The reality is that if people hear a case that comes out of America or Europe, they'll take it with more seriousness than they do if they hear a case from Sri Lanka or India. And that's, we're talking about the reception in the scientific community here. So this is something which is kind of disappointing. But anyway, moving along. So this is a list of objections which is found in a book by Paul Edwards called Reincarnation, A Critical Examination. And I came across this through the quotes by another fellow called Robert Kogan, a book called Critical Thinking Step by Step. So he was commenting on Paul Edwards' book, and so he's summarizing the arguments made by Paul Edwards. And I will look at each one of these. So this is, well, we certainly don't try to say this is an exhaustive list of critical arguments, but it's a typical list from a fairly reputable source. So the first one is, how does a soul exist between bodies? Right, so this is one of the objections. There's no mechanism. How do you explain that? Look, why don't I take the skeptic side? I'll quiz Venerable Marley on this and see if he can come up with an answer. So here, Venerable, can you come up with an answer for this? Why? How is it that souls can exist in between bodies?
I've already argued enough with you about it. I don't want to argue in public with you as well. This is going to be terrible. Okay, so, but basically I think the answer to this one is essentially that what we're dealing with here, with the scientific method, is about accumulating evidence, right? You accumulate anecdotes, you look at the reality of things. And when you look at the reality, the theory is secondary. Do these phenomena actually happen? And if they happen, if you can show that there is a link between a person's previous life and the present life, that is what matters. If it doesn't kind of fit with prevailing ideas or prevailing theories of how the world works, well, maybe there's a problem with the theory. You know, the point here is that the data have to come first. And the data is what matters. And that is how science evolves, right? You observe, you bring in data, and as you look at the data, you have to refine your theories and change your theories. If you take your theories as given, of course, you're never going to go anywhere. You're basically stuck in the way things are at the moment. So data has to come first, and then theories come as a secondary matter. Yeah. So...
I mean, and the same thing, of course, happens in the physical sciences, and a good example being, Galileo and observing the movements of the planetary bodies and so on, and then through Newton, and you can actually see the workings of gravity and so on. But they had no idea how is that working, right? I mean, you can see that there's that you can explain these things, you can see that there's a pattern which you can understand, but you don't have any mechanism, and of course it took a long time to get any kind of explanation of that. Really, in physics today, there's still really no widely accepted mechanism for how gravity works, right? And yet that doesn't stop things from falling down.
I also saw, I think there was another thing I saw recently about the laws of motion. And I think Newton was saying in those days that the laws of motion are impossible to really work out in a kind of consistent way, you know, how it actually works, how it functions. And what happened with the laws of motion, or with the fact that there is motion at all, they just put that question aside, the philosophical question about how it actually works, right. They put it aside because they knew there was motion, and they continue working with the thing without really explaining what's going on.
Right.
So very often there are, you know, lots of unexplained phenomena within science, which you just put to one side, which you don't really worry about, because you, in the end, you just give up. You know, you continue with what works, and you function on that basis, basically.
Mm. Okay, so you've answered that one. I'll give you that one. Okay, well, next one. Tertullian's objection. So Tertullian.
Yeah, we have to turn the tables here, right? So now it's my turn to question you. Okay. So otherwise, it gets unfair. Okay. So this I think is an ancient Greek philosopher or something, Roman, the Tertullian, Roman or Greek, probably maybe Roman, Tertullian.
One of the early church fathers.
Fathers, okay, Tertullian's objection. So he is, he was presumably Christian, and that's why he was against reincarnation.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says the following: if there is reincarnation, why are not babies born with the mental abilities of adults? Ha, got you. So, now, say your thesis if you can. Yeah.
Well, I know you're right, actually. Yeah, I give up. Okay, hang on. So why aren't babies born with the mental abilities of adults? Well, obviously, because they're babies. I don't know. I don't even. Is there even a case to answer? I mean, obviously, people. There's a process of change, and they've died, which is presumably a somewhat traumatic experience, and they've got reborn, spent 9 months in a womb, growing and getting a new brain and all of that kind of thing. I mean, does that actually affect your cognitive faculties? Well, one would expect so. I mean, getting a bump on your head affects your cognitive faculties. Having a couple of glasses of wine affects your cognitive faculties. You'd imagine that, you know, 9 years of growing a brain inside a mother's womb is going to affect your cognitive faculties. And 9 months, whatever, 9 years, I was... Details. So I mean, I think this is pretty clear. In the Buddhist theory of Buddhist cosmology, there is this idea of what they call the upapatika satta, which is the beings who are spontaneously reborn. That means they don't go through that whole post process of gestation and so on. And it's and when they are reborn, like beings in the deva realm and things like that, that they do have their memories intact. So having not gone through that whole process, then they keep their memories. Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things that I think actually is an interesting question, right? It is obviously an interesting question. Why does this change? And I think one of the answers to that is the theory that was developed by this psychologist called Myers, and this is a theory which I think is often accepted in circles who, you know, among scientists who believe that the mind can be separated from material phenomena. And this is the theory which is called the transmission theory of consciousness, the filter theory of consciousness. So the mind is filtered through the brain. The brain functions as a transmission entity or a filter for the mind. And of course, because, and we know that it must be the case, right? If you damage the brain, the mind is affected. You can't think properly anymore. So obviously there is a connection there. It doesn't mean that you're actually damaging the mind. It means that you're damaging the filter through which the mind operates. And of course, this is what's happening here. If you are a baby, your filter is very small, right, and very undeveloped. You have a very, very primitive filter. Because the filter is so primitive, the mind is kind of held back from its full potential, which it otherwise would have. So you actually come into that life with the full potential, and then you are constricted by the new brain, you know, the fetus, and then the baby later on. And then as you then grow up, the mind is allowed then to express itself again as the brain develops as you get older. It's a very interesting idea, this idea of filter mechanism, because it means that basically the physical body and the brain as we have it is a limitation of the mind, right? And that's why when you do things like regression therapy or you kind of go into the fourth jhana and you're starting to release the mind from the physical constraints, then you can actually access deeper aspects of yourself, deeper aspects of the mind, which otherwise are not really accessible. And that presumably would then be things like the unconscious and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And just as a note on that theory of the filter theory or transmission theory of the brain is the basis for the book on the irreducible mind, which we showed you before, and it's developed in quite a lot of detail there. So it's a very interesting way of looking at it. Okay, my turn. Okay, Venerable Sir. Reincarnation claims an infinite series of prior incarnations, which seems a bit of a... Anyway, we're given that. Evolution teaches that there was a time when humans did not yet exist. So, reincarnation is inconsistent with modern science.
Right. okay, so, when you talked about Mars before, weren't you, aliens, that sort of thing? So, uh-huh. It's obvious there were green men in the past. If you go far enough back, you were a green man, probably, with antennas, that sort of thing. That's one possibility. But obviously, I think the Buddhist answer here is very obvious, because, precisely because you can be reborn in various realms and various things, you could have been whatever else in the past life. You could have been a god, right? Perhaps a god which was slightly lower than now, which was approximately equivalent even to the human realm. Because these realms, I think one of the important things to understand about these realms that beings exist in, is they are flexible. Realms are not fixed into a certain position. It's not, they move in terms of the lifespan and the happiness and the type of experiences you have in those realms. There was a certain movement, a fluctuation over time. So it may have been that at that time, people who are now reborn as human beings were reborn in a realm which was more like a Deva realm, right? A lower Deva realm, or something like that. So I think from a Buddhist point of view, it's not really a big problem at all. It could even be possible that at a certain point, you were reborn in a different world system, right? One of the fascinating things about the suttas is to talk about different world systems, like different, perhaps different... solar systems, right, or different galaxies or something like that. This is one of the amazing things that you actually find in the suttas. So that is my answer. Would you like to add anything, Pantita?
Only to say that specific issue is actually dealt with at quite some length in the suttas, especially in the Agamya Sutta, where you have an account which deals with both rebirth and evolution. Yeah, and there's an actual theory of evolution that talks about a time before human beings existed and beings be reborn in that. So it's not as if it was something which is unknown to the Buddha or anything like that. So that's the Agnya Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. Again, highly recommended, very interesting sutta. Okay.
So I apologize for giving you this incredibly bad argument, but it's on the list, so I have to give it to you. If there is reincarnation, then what is happening when the population increases?
Okay, well, sometimes when a man and a woman love each other very much...
What's happening when the population increases?
Well, I think probably the same answer as we gave before, that there is different realms, particularly the animal realm and so on, and so beings can shift between one realm and the other, or sometimes maybe remain in between lives for long periods of time and so on and so forth. So the population is shifting and changing all the time, and that's just how it goes. Okay, so now my turn. Okay, if there is reincarnation, then why do so few, if any, people remember past lives?
I think we pretty much answered that one already by using the filter theory of mind. Is that you go through this process of being, being 9 months in this tiny little being right in the womb, and then you go through the being a baby for a long period of time. And you are constricted by that existence. And of course, there is a limit to the type of, you are, because that existence is so basic and the mind can only express itself in such a basic way, you obviously lose a lot of those memories through that. So the mind is again very constricted by that. And the whole trauma of getting reborn is probably so powerful that that also means that you perhaps lose some of the memories. But I wonder whether it also has something to do with the past, with the actual antrabhava, the intermediate existence. Because one of the fascinating things in Ian Stevenson's books is that it is much more likely that you will remember your past life if you died traumatically in the past life. If you died in an accident, right, and you died instantaneously, very fast, and then you get kind of reborn immediately, then you're actually much more likely to have a past life memory than if you die in an ordinary sense. So what that might mean is actually the intermediate existence may actually be where this memory is lost, perhaps. I think it is fairly clear from the suttas that there is such a thing as an intermediate existence between when you die and then when you're reborn. This is contrary to the Theravada received opinion, but that I think is fairly clear from the suttas. So that is perhaps where you lose it when I think about it now, actually, rather than through the process of being reborn, perhaps.
Well, if it was the intermediate existence, then what about the Upapadika Sutta? Because they presume they have an intermediate existence, but they can remember.
Maybe they don't have an intermediate existence, because you know, maybe you become so
they
powerful,
do.
You get reborn straight away.
What about the Antaraparinipai? Yeah, you got
but
there.
It's very short. We're getting very technical. Okay. That's true. There is Antaraparinipai. Yeah. But maybe again,
I think it's different times of Antarabhavas, right?
Different where the process
is. Sure.
Yeah?
But I think, to me, it seems more likely it's when you get, you know, I mean, it's, I mean you're in the bog, and then you get released from it, and you're flying up in the sky, and it's when you get enmeshed in the bog again, that was with, you know, when you come back and you get reborn and all of that stuff, it seemed to me that's more...
Sure, but then you have to explain this reason why you're dying
exactly.
Violently,
yeah.
Actually has an effect. I have to explain that one.
Yeah.
But it's actually an interesting question altogether, and this is, we're getting really sidetracked now, but it's an interesting question. Why does the Buddha say that birth is suffering? Yeah. What's the reason for that? And I often wonder whether it is the inverse. When you die, right, you're freed from the body. And many people say that when you're freed from the body, when you die, especially when you're old, the body is bad, the mind is freed, you feel happy, right? Whoa, finally, rid of that terrible body which was so ill and decrepit and all this kind of things. It's wonderful when I've been to Ajahn Brahm a few times, the hospital, and somebody's lying on the bed and dying, right? And everybody around is crying. And Ajahn Brahm says, wonderful, you're on the way out, great, you know, you get rid of this body, we'll be so happy, what a wonderful thing. It's the exact opposite of what everybody else is thinking. And it's a wonderful change of perception, right? But I wonder whether actually being reborn and going into the womb is the exact opposite of that, right? Here you are, free, right, finally out of the body. And then you see yourself moving towards this thing, right? Mm. And you're actually being trapped in exactly the same suffering that you have just arisen from. Mm. You're moving towards being trapped into that again. And when you see that, I can imagine that will actually be tremendous suffering. You feel a sense of panic. Mm. And perhaps that is part of the problem there as well.
Mm. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when we do the funeral chants, you know, in Buddhism, the most famous funeral chant that we do is Anitavata Sankara Upadavaya Dhammino Upadjitva Nirudhanti Te Sanghupasamo Sukho. Alas, all conditions are impermanent, their subject to rise and fall. Having risen, they pass away. Their stilling is happiness. So this is actually what we're saying to people in Pali when their beloved ones have died, right? The fact that your beloved one has passed away is happiness. Yeah? And of course that verse was very famously uttered at the time of the Buddha's passing away, right? The Buddha's parinibbana. So for him, yes, of course, right? That's the real stilling. But it's interesting that that's the verse which is chosen to use at funerals, and that's what we're essentially chanting every time we do funeral chants. We're saying, "Oh, isn't it nice that your mother has passed away?"
I was just wanting to add to what Venerable was saying about rebirth and suffering. If anyone's had a newborn or been around a newborn, they don't actually smile back at you for a good couple of weeks, but quite often you see them smiling in their sleep and they can really get a big grin on their face, and mm-hmm. we're told that it's wind, but there's no way, we don't smile when we have wind as adults, so
wind.
but yeah, so that would be my point, is that there's some awareness of happiness and joy in a very young newborn.
Yeah, interesting. Look, and I have to say, my suspicion is, look, you know, us two, we're a pair of monks up here who don't know anything about this stuff, right? And most of this, you know, researchers are blokes, and I've been very kind of conscious of that. But I have no doubt that there is a wealth of wisdom in the knowledge of mothers about all of these things, which actually is far more real and grounded than a lot of this research. And I wish we could have accessed that or talked about that more. Yeah. Nija mata sankara.
Hello. What about this idea that maybe we want to forget when we get a new opportunity to be reborn and try again? Maybe all those things, especially if we remember a lot of painful experience from death, then it's just easier to put it behind. Also, another idea was this idea that actually in the, was it the Payasi Sutta, that there's different time zone. I mean, the concept of time is different when in the human realm, when you're out there somewhere. Mm. Maybe it's like how we forget things, that maybe it's like so long ago, the last life, that you just naturally can't be bothered with it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. One of the interesting things about the Payasi Sutta is it actually has the concept of relative movement of time, and talks about how time in the different realms moves at very different paces. And that's actually a very sophisticated idea. And I'm not aware of any other text that early that actually has that idea, that time is subjective and moves in different places, different speeds in different contexts. So that's, I think, interesting that that's first found in a Buddhist text, or perhaps in a Jaina text, depending.
Yeah. There's a nice story about that. I think, I can't remember where it is now. There's a story about the Deva, one of these heavenly beings, who dies from the heavenly realm, right? And when they die in the heavenly realm, suddenly one day you just disappear. And then you get reborn in the human realm, and kind of, you know, does things, you know, do all kind of things, and has an ordinary human life. Goes on for about 100 years. And after it dies as a human being, it gets reborn back into the same Deva realm again, right? And then when the Devas see him, this God see him, they say, "Oh, what happened to you? We haven't seen you all day here. You've been..." So in the Deva realm, one day, 100 years of the human existence. Well, there you are.
Okay, so we'll move on. We've just got a little bit left. We'd just like to finish off. Another skeptical argument here. And this is, I think, more central, really, to the skeptical argument, is the idea, essentially, of the kind of materialist argument. If you assume that the brain is the cause of mental states, then when the brain dies, then those mental states will also die. And I think it's important to understand, to acknowledge that there's quite a lot of support for that idea, i.e. the fact that people die, right? I mean, every time somebody dies, that's what happens, right? That's what we can observe, right? We observe that their physical body dies and we can't see anything else continuing on, right? So it's not as if there's no evidence for that. There's actually, like, every time somebody dies, there's a piece of evidence for that. But of course, that doesn't prove that that's what's happening. It just proves that that's what we can observe, okay? Now, that case is made a bit more specifically here, the case against immortality by Keith Augustine. From the fact that all of the mental states we have a good understanding of depend on the brain, we can reasonably extrapolate, as neuroscientists do, that all mental states depend on the brain. This is the argument he's giving, and I think in that argument encapsulates a lot of the very deep fallacies in this kind of way of thinking. First thing is, mental states we have a good understanding of. I'd like to see a list of those. What's the actual mental states that, from a neuroscientific background, that we actually have a good understanding of? my understanding would be that there aren't any, and that we don't have an understanding of basic mental concepts like consciousness from a neuroscientific background. And if you can't understand consciousness, then you can't understand any mental state. I had a very interesting conversation about this with an actual living, breathing neuroscientist a few weeks ago, who happened to be visiting Santi Monastery last time I was there. And she was the head of a medical department at a university who specializes in neuroscience. And I asked her some of these very same questions. And she just laughed and said, this is just nonsense. Right? The idea that you can say, you know, you have memory in this part of the brain and feeling in this part of the brain and so on, it's just nonsense. Right? That these things happen in such complex ways, and the more and more that you go into it with neuroscience, the more you see that they're all nuanced and it changes. Everyone's brain works in different ways. Memory happens in lots of different ways, in different contexts. And our ability to see and understand what's happening in a brain through fMRI scans and these kinds of things is very limited. The scale of resolution that we're seeing is extremely coarse. Right? You're not seeing things at the level of an individual neuron. And our understanding of things like what's the relationship between individual events in neurons and patterns of complex events in many neurons, right? These things are things that we can't see. All we can see through an fMRI scan, for example, is the fact that there's probably more iron in this part of the brain. Right, that's what an fMRI scan actually sees, magnetic resonance, right? So you see there's more iron in this part of the brain, so therefore there's probably more blood. And if there's probably more blood, then there's probably more neurons doing some work. And if there's probably more neurons doing some work, then there's probably some mental activity associated with that, right? So this is the kind of chain of reasoning. It's not as if you can look into the thing and see what is actually happening in a person's brain. So to say here, as neuroscientists do, well, yeah, not all neuroscientists do that. So you've now argued from something which is demonstrably untrue. We can understand some mental states to then assume that all mental states depend on the brain. I think this is simply a nonsensical argument, and really to me exposes how weak this whole reductive argument is.
And that is, of course, only one of the fallacies here. We have the second fallacy, I would say, from a Buddhist point of view, is the fact that we have a good understanding that these actually depend on the brain, right? I mean, we can say that they are conditioned by the brain. The brain certainly matters for the mental states. We're just talking about the filter theory. So obviously, the filter has an effect. You know, the way the filter works will affect how the mind actually expresses itself. But again, from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't actually... There is no sense of dependency there. There's just a correlation between these things. It affects it. But the mind actually, you know, would then be prior to these things. And the filter would kind of narrow it down. And it depends. And it is correlated to the brain, but not does not depend on the brain in that way.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Another comment here. This is a philosopher called Bernardo Kastrup. Yeah. He's talking about this idea of the strong emergence of consciousness from the brain. So I hope you understand what this idea is. And so this is a way of thinking about the relationship between the mind and the brain, the idea being that consciousness is an emergent phenomenon from the brain. And so the idea is that you can have a brain which is a purely material thing, and as you organize that into sort of greater and more complex levels of organization, somehow consciousness pops out on top of it. Okay, so this is idea that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain, and Kastrup criticizes this in quite strong terms. I think it's an appeal to magic. It's a label for something that we don't know, or that we can't even conceive, to give it a label, and it sounds like we know because we give it a name. So this is this I think, very strong and I think very, very cogent critique of this concept of emergence. It's, to me, it's just putting a label on something because it sounds like it's kind of scientific. But one of the big problems with the whole theory of emergence and that consciousness is an epiphenomenon is that if consciousness is merely an epiphenomenon of the brain, first of all, why should it matter? And secondly, if it was, then causality would only work one way, right? The brain would cause consciousness, but the consciousness wouldn't have any causal effect on the brain, right? But that's not what our experience is it, right? Our experience is that both of these things can influence each other. We can change the way our brain is. For example, we can have a few glasses of scotch. That'll change how our brain chemistry works, right? And it'll also change how our mental faculties work, right? We can see physical things can affect our mind. But we can also see the opposite, right? We can see that we can make a choice, a mental choice, right? To, for example, to stop thinking angry thoughts, right? And we can see that that will actually have an effect on our brain and on our body and on our physical being as well. Yeah? So these things, from a Buddhist point of view, they're always interrelated. Our actual reality, where we live, is neither a world of pure matter, nor is it a world of pure consciousness. The world that we live in is a world where these things are always interrelated. Right? There are physical and mental things. As you're sitting here right now, there are physical phenomena going on. You can see, you can hear, you can feel your body. There are also mental things happening, right? You've got emotions, you have thoughts, you have ideas, you have memories, you have a little thought, oh, 6:30, dinner time, right? And all of these little things are happening. And my body and brain are relating to each other. That's our reality, is a relationship between mind and body. And when we separate, it's only either through analysis or through investigation or in unusual cases that we can actually tease these things apart, right? It's not like in Western philosophy, they often have this dualistic idea that mind and body are like separate substances, and that therefore you have a big problem. How do they relate to each other? How do you combine these two separate substances? Right? From a Buddhist point of view, it's exactly the opposite approach. The primary reality is not two separate substances. The primary reality is the connection between the mind and the body. Cakkhuncha paticca rupeccha upajati cakkhu viññāna. The basic analysis of consciousness, depending on eye and forms, arises eye consciousness. The coming together of the three is contact. Dhyanang sangati passo. That's our given. That's the world of experience in which we live. And so it's through analysis and understanding that we can see that there are these different aspects, but the primary reality is the relationship between things, which is what experience is, exactly. And just to finish off, very briefly, we'd like to play another short clip by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he's talking about some of these same issues. Same caveat, just remember, as before, this is from the Skype interview, the lack of syncing of the audio due to my personal clumsiness in doing the recording wrong. Okay.
First of all, I'd say is that science itself, or scientists themselves, as long as they are really being scientific, cannot undermine or disprove the teaching of rebirth. What has happened is that because science has proved to be very effective in generating knowledge about the physical world by working from the hypothesis that the physical world is the domain that we have to understand. So because science has been so effective by using that particular premise or starting point, scientists have jumped to conclusions about things that lie outside the domain of the physical world. And so science could be a very powerful means of knowledge in understanding everything about the physical world, from the structure of cells down to the structure of molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, and outward to understanding solar systems, galaxies, interrelations of galaxies, and so on. And so all of this works and generates a tremendous amount of knowledge when one adopts the premise that I'm going to keep my investigations within the realm of physical phenomena. But then when one jumps to the conclusion, therefore, mind, consciousness, mental processes can be reduced to physical phenomena, or can be entirely explained
on the basis of physical phenomena, then what has actually left the track of pure science and one has accepted a metaphysic. The metaphysic that what is real and the only thing that is real, the base of everything else, is physical phenomena. And just last week I read a book, I think it's quite an important book, by an American philosopher. His name is Thomas Nagel. He's a professor of philosophy at New York University. It's called Mind and Cosmos. And he develops a critique of physicalist reductionism, and he holds that the premise of physical reductionism cannot even explain the phenomena of life itself. You know, from the premise that physical phenomena alone are real, one still has enormous difficulty in explaining how so quickly within the development of the earth chains of molecules formed into the chains of atoms formed into complex molecules that were capable of self-replication. And then it's, he also argues that it's virtually impossible to explain on the basis even of chains of complex molecules how a phenomenon like mind or consciousness can emerge.
So we wanted to include that. I think that's a really kind of good summary of that that position. And Bhikkhubodhi is always very eloquent and to the point. And so, you know, I think from a Buddhist point of view that we should value and appreciate the contributions of science and always be ready to learn from it. And if there are things in Buddhism that we find to be, you know, untrue or whatever, then that's fine. But we also need to keep a critical view towards the claims of science itself, especially when they veer towards the more metaphysical. Do you have anything to add to that, Venerable? That's it. Okay, very good. So I think we might be just about ready to wrap up. So thanks everybody for your attendance and for your attention. Thanks for your good stories and questions, everything. Thanks Venerable Brahmali for participating, and thank you to the BSWA for hosting us, to Lynn and caretakers here for helping out. Thanks to our volunteers on the IT and audio, and to who else do we need to thank? Me. Thank you to me. Yes. And Dennis and Alan and Venerable Chaga and everybody else who's helped out for today. We will be back next month, or I'll be back. I think you're going to be not here next month. Your Venerable's going to be away next month. Sad face, everybody. Anyway, so I'll be back next month for the fifth workshop, which is discussing the question, more broad philosophical questions of meaning and interpretation. How do these teachings fit in within some of the more profound teachings in the Buddhist canon, and how do we address some of the more difficult problems which were raised, many of which were raised in today's workshop. So that will be next month. As usual, the reading is available for you, so you're all encouraged to do the reading before the workshop. One thing to bear in mind is that what we did when we structured the course is that we left the final workshop somewhat open. Okay, so we gave a clear structure to the first five workshops, and the sixth workshop we haven't given much of a structure to. And so that's something that we'd like to maybe get some feedback from you in the next workshop and see what you're interested in to look more at in the sixth workshop. Is there something that you'd like to see more of, an area that perhaps we've left unexplored, or something you'd like to see some more details about? So we'll be getting some feedback from you next month about what we're going to do in the last workshop. finally, so if you're interested to make any donations, Lynn has the donation box there, sadhu, 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 and donations will be there for Sutta Central. And just I've talked about this every time, so you're probably very bored of it, but anyway, I will do so again. So Sutta Central is, of course, the best website in the world. And it has, we have the Buddhist text now in 30 languages. And when I did this kind of graphic which defines these things, and I have to keep on revising the graphic because we kept on adding more languages and more texts and things like that. But anyway, it's my guesstimation at the moment. 30 languages, 50,000 texts, 15,000 parallels, and 60 million words, approximately. And one Dhamma, I believe, so far. Well, I don't know. I haven't read all of the 60 million words, so it might not be entirely one Dhamma, but more or less one Dhamma. And so Sutta Central is now, we've now successfully incorporated and formed the Sutta Central Development Trust. So on the website, on Sutta Central website, we now have online donations. So if you are able to make an online donation, either one-off or a monthly donation, then that is very, very greatly appreciated. And that will help us to continue to develop Sutta Central and make it even better. We have many things that we're working on, and of course never enough time to be able to implement all of the good ideas that we have. Currently we're working on projects to digitize the Hindi translations of the Pali Canon. We're also on another project to finalize and improve the Sinhala digital text, as well as beginning a project to digitize the Bengali translation of the Pali Canon, and also looking into a project for the Japanese translation. So these are multiple projects that we're working on at the moment, as well as a number of other things. So our aim is that ultimately we can bring the words of the Buddha to everybody in their own language. As the Buddha said, that you should learn the Dhamma in your own language. We've done a nice sort of fundraising brochure, which I think maybe Lynn, do you want to hold up a copy of the brochure down the back? And so we have that there for you. If you want some more details and information, then please pick up a copy of the brochure, especially if you think there's anybody that might be interested in it, so you can share that around and give them the information. And of course you can always ask myself if you want any more information about Sutta Central. So I believe that that is all for today. So let us finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.